Welcome everyone to the January meeting of the Humanist Union of Madison. Today we have an open discussion of news stories that we found of particular significance to humanists during 2009. And we'll wind up with collecting your ideas on program ideas for the coming year for the Humanist Union. So we're open for news stories.
Well, I'm going to start with one, which I didn't bring with me. I had too many things to bring to others, and so I left all my stories. But there are, I don't know if this fits exactly into news, but it's from blogs. There are more and more incidences of opposing groups hacking each other's websites. And there is some, and I don't know if it's the, I don't know which group it is, but they are accusing a humanist group, not any that I know of, but a humanist group of hacking their website. There's other hackings that are going the other way around, and I think this is something that is emerging in a disturbing way to me, that whether we agree with each other or not, we ought not to be taking away each other's voices. And I don't like the notion of a humanist group doing it, and I don't like the notion of a religious right group doing it, and I regret that I didn't bring my material with me, because it's not in my head. But it's just an issue that I want to bring up that I think we need to be aware of, and I don't know if Bob, you know, you're the one that runs our website, whether there's ever been any attempt to hack ours or to leave nasties on the website. But
and I haven't heard of any humanist group doing that. Maybe some people who claim to be humanists.
I will go back and try to find my source on that. Because again, and someone may just be wanting to give them a bad name by saying that they're doing.
Well, yeah, they might even want an excuse for retaliating.
I will look that up.
Did anyone read the issue of Isthmus with the Freedom from Religion?
Jen Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor?
Yes.
On the front. That was quite an article. I'm sorry I didn't read it.
The follow-up issue had a lot of letters which are almost universally condemnatory of even mentioning that atheists exist.
Yeah, today's, this week's Isthmus, I brought those letters. And there are 7 letters that they printed, 5 of which are really radically, violently opposed to the Isthmus's coverage of the atheists, the Freedom of Religion Foundation stuff. And for example, here's the last paragraph of the first letter. It says, Isthmus, by touting the falsehoods of atheism and denying God as the ultimate authority, is contributing to this gradual destruction of our society and my beloved country. Hear, hear.
How come he says gradual?
Yeah, there's
all of them. Is it as bad as even women the right to vote, you suppose?
That was along the lines.
Beginning of the end.
I have a question. This guy who came, it was the atheist guy from Minnesota, he had a license plate that said atheist. Could you do that in Wisconsin?
Yep.
Can you put a religious thing on there? Which is what I suppose you consider to be.
The primary requirement is that it not be obnoxious, like a swear word or, you know.
So you couldn't do that then?
Well, yeah.
These people would find it obnoxious.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has to be found obnoxious by an employee of the Department of Transportation.
Aren't they limited to 6 or 7 characters?
7, I believe.
Would that be treated like religion? When you think about it, we're against having our government pay for a religion or on any government property? Is atheism considered, because it's anti-religion, is it considered a religion of its own? Or, you know, sometimes they act like that.
If you get a specialized license plate, you've got to pay for it.
Yes.
Yeah. It's the paying for it that makes it, I mean, you pay for it, so it is your license plate. Mm-hmm. It is not a public license plate. The differentiation with the freedom from religion is the public shouldn't have to pay for any religion, which is, for example, why they're against faith-based that faith-based office in the federal government.
As long as it's paid by a private group, then it's all right.
This issue did come up, I think maybe it was in Georgia, where the state wanted to put a religious slogan on all
the
license.
I believe was the statement, I believe.
South Carolina.
Last edition of Church and State, I think that'll put a long article on.
Complete and rational discourse.
Well, just to complete that, people who weren't here when this guy spoke, he said that nobody had ever really confronted him about that, but he would get pamphlets under his license, or under his
windshield
wipers. And he said half of them told him how much God loved him, and the other half told him all the terrible things that were going to happen to him. God was going to do to him.
It's August Berkshire, by the way. I finally remember
that's
his name.
That's his name, yes. Very interesting guy.
Well, I brought two news items, one of which was a sort of disturbing development in Europe, which we normally think of as being more enlightened than the religion-drenched United States, but they're taking what I consider to be an unfortunate turn in the direction of censorship by reinstituting blasphemy laws. And they're doing this, for all the best motives, of course, which everybody always does. They want to avoid offending people, and one way to give offense is by criticizing their religion. And, you know, when you criticize someone's religion, they seem to take greater offense than if you criticize their hairstyle or their clothing choice or their kid's performance in school or anything like that. And so they get very upset if somebody says stuff like Islam is a religion of violence and destruction. And so they say, well, that constitutes, you know, if you say bad things about the Prophet, that's blasphemy. It makes people really mad. And so we will, rather than bring legal action against the folks who firebombed your house, we'll bring legal action against you because you're the one that set them off with your provocative comments. Interestingly, you would think that the United Nations, which is supposed to defend the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, would be in the forefront of the opposition to this, when in fact they seem to be enablers and co-facilitators of it. So that's a disturbing trend in the international scene. Something from the wonderful world of science, is working its way slowly into the public consciousness, is this idea that I certainly have touted for many years, that all there is to the universe is matter and energy. It turns out that the matter and energy we are capable of detecting amounts to something like 5% of the total content of the universe. Another 20% is something called dark matter. Nobody has a clue what it is. And another 75% is called dark energy. And people are, you know, if you think that dark matter is a great mystery, dark energy is just completely off the map. Nobody has the vaguest idea what it is. But it constitutes something like 70%, 75% of the entire universe. It is my... it's been my prediction for a number of years now, and I'm sure that any year now we'll see this prediction come true, that as soon as word of this trickles into the somewhat turgid minds of the religious community and certainly the woo-woo paranormal types, is they'll start attributing everything that we can't understand to the presence of dark matter and dark energy, and they'll use as their justification for doing it, well, see, you science guys don't really know anything. All these years you've been telling us there's nothing but matter and energy out there, and you're missing 95% of the picture. Well, you know, if there are any real substance to that, they would have been the ones to first notice the missing 95%. But in fact, it was science that first noticed the missing 95%. They're busy trying to figure out what it is. You know, any knowledge we have whatsoever about it comes through the workings of science, not through the workings of the tarot deck or prayer to the divine beings. And so, yes, I'm sure they're going to all leap on this bandwagon and say, this is what we can do to explain all those mysterious lights that, you know, you guys said that they weren't UFOs, but ha, ha, see, it's dark energy, ha. I expect we'll see this any day now.
How can they put a percentage on it if they don't know what it
It does have any a detectable effect, and the question is, well, what's causing the detectable effect? The two detectable effects are that, and we can only see this at a great distance with things involving gargantuan amounts of matter, specifically galaxies. The galaxies seem to be moving apart from each other faster than could be explained by the residual motion left over from the Big Bang. In fact, they seem to be speeding up as they move apart from each other.
Like they're being pushed apart.
Like they're
doesn't
being pushed
make
apart.
Any sense
it doesn't, you know, and
so
and it's sort of like it's sort of like the reverse of gravity. It's sort of like reverse gravity, mm-hmm. And gravity, unlike electromagnetic attraction, in electromagnetic, you have the north and south poles, and you got the positive and negative charges, and so they seem to come in pairs, but gravity only seems to work one way. It seems to work in. While this stuff, whatever it is, seems to work in only one way as well. It works out. And so you got gravity pulling things in and this dark energy pushing things out, and it looks like over the long haul, the dark energy, which is also sometimes called quintessence because it's the fifth major known force, or we think it's a force, is probably going to dominate over intergalactic distances. And then the dark matter is accounts for speed of rotation of the galaxies more than the presence of visible matter.
Maybe. Matter being pushed out and matter being pulled in, doesn't that keep everything in equilibrium?
No.
If the two forces were equal, yes, but they aren't.
Maybe they were off in calculating the size of the sphere that we live in.
Well, the problem is that we can't see farther away than if the universe has been around for, I think, 14.6 billion years is the latest estimate. Given the speed of light, we can't see farther away than 14.6 billion light years. And so anything that's going on beyond that, we don't have a clue as to what it is.
What I think is interesting in that whole thing is for a while they were saying that if there was more mass in the universe, that, you know, they were talking about the expansion and was it going to expand forever or would it ultimately
collapse.
Contract? And that was based on the amount of matter. And they thought if there was more matter, it would contract. But in fact, they discovered all this extra matter, the dark, and it's, but the forces aren't going to contract it. They're actually pushing it apart actively. So it kind of speaks to the idea of the universe going on and on and on, expanding forever until, you know, we're all by our lonesome in the dark.
One of the reasons they're able to come up with the percentages they have is that the dark matter has a tendency to pull things in. It operates gravitationally, and the dark energy has a tendency to push things apart. And the dark energy seems to, at this point, be three times as dominant in its effects as the dark matter, thus the ratio 75% to 20%.
Right, because if it was just matter,
it would ultimately collapse.
And it doesn't seem to be what's happening.
With a collider testing today in Switzerland as well as in Illinois, when do you think they will be able to harness that antimatter for power?
Probably never, because you need to get a supply of it, and in order to get a supply of it, you have to treat existing matter with gargantuan amounts more energy than you could possibly get out of it.
I think he's talking about converting normal matter to energy.
Well, there's a couple things going on here. One is matter and energy can be interconverted using Einstein's famous formula equals mc squared. But the other thing is that there is such a thing as antimatter, and the problem that physicists have faced for a long time is why is our universe made up so much of matter and hardly any antimatter? I mean, you'd think that if the two were created in roughly equal quantities back in the Big Bang, they would have instantly annihilated each other, and it doesn't seem to have happened. So we seem to live in a universe made up entirely of matter. Where's the antimatter?
It's
we can create it.
It's in some other universe that's the opposite kind.
Sorry?
It's in some other universe elsewhere that's the opposite kind of
that. That, in fact, is one of the possible explanations. Is that at the time of the Big Bang, things shot off in two different directions, and we got all the matter, and somebody else got all the antimatter. That is one of the possible explanations. But we can create antimatter very briefly and momentarily in our universe by plowing gigantic amounts of energy into the process and keeping the results separated by means of vacuum and magnets from the real matter surrounding it. But as soon as the two of them interact in any fashion, they mutually annihilate. And so you can't keep it long enough to do any good. And in order to use it as fuel, we'd have to get more energy out of the process than we put in, and we're nowhere close to being able to do that.
It's a whole new frontier, though, isn't it?
Right.
We should all scientists and the non-scientists should be having their minds open and waiting and exchanging ideas that are fighting about it.
That's one of the things about science, is it's always changing and it's always being tested and theories proved and disproved. Whereas religion is often pretty fixed, revealed truth, and 2,000-year-old document, this is all we need to know.
Well, I know the scientists, the Russians and NASA, they're thinking, and others are trying to get together and send something to stop an asteroid. I mean, that's one of the things they were thinking of cooperating, and the Russians were instigating and sending. They were thinking of ways they could get the asteroid to veer off away from the Earth.
Carl Sagan had an interesting take on that. For much of his career, he said, we really need to develop space capabilities so we can fend off the asteroid that might have our name on it. And Isaac Asimov once said, well, the real reason the dinosaurs are extinct is because they didn't have a space program. So there was that strain of thought. But toward the end of his career, Sagan changed his mind. And he said, you know, the same technique, the same technology that could be used to cause an asteroid to veer away from the Earth could be used to cause one to veer toward the Earth. And we know that killer asteroids come along every 50, 60 billion years, million years, sorry. Every 50, 60 million years, but we know that tin pot dictators with delusions of world domination come along about every 5 or 6 years. And given the odds of this technology being used for ill instead of for good, I think I'd rather take my chances with the asteroids.
You know, when the religion strike was down on listening for other intelligent beings with their attitude of having the truth from some unique source of the governance and the rules of the universe, shouldn't they be taking the initiative and spending vast sums of money to be the senders rather than the receivers of information? It's a kind of the logical conclusion of proselytizing religion.
Send it out to the universe.
Yeah. And so instead of being against listening, we should be in favor of broadcasting.
You will not be surprised to find that that's a recurrent theme in science fiction. And the current thinking is, given how little we know about who might possibly be listening out there, we're probably better off keeping our mouths shut. Let's get back to
that. I think there's a crazy thing that happened a year ago at the World Day of Prayer in Wautoma, and they always get on the courthouse square and they have these ceremonies, and this guy gave the prayer, the evangelical, and he said, I'd be thankful for this great country, I'm thankful for our boys fighting overseas, and thankful for gravity. I never thought of that, you know? Just like, with a little less, we don't fly off, the other boy squashes down. So I cut it out of the paper. Gravity, where the hell did that come from? Magnetism? But I wonder now, you're talking about gravity and anti-gravity. Maybe there was something to that. Maybe you read something about the anti-gravity.
Yeah, that's unusual to hear somebody, you know, the evangelical actually thanking gravity.
It's bizarre. It's really bizarre. But maybe something, maybe you read something while you're talking about anti-matter and everything.
I've heard many prayers from fundamentalists. And they include the physical universe in their prayers all the time. So different terms and related to it. That doesn't surprise me at all.
Fundamentalist daughter who's homeschooling her children and I cleanse of their science books every once in a while. And there's all this is right side by side. These are physical laws. And they're that way because that's the way God made them.
So they're acknowledging that
gravity is a gift. Way back when I was a student in Berkeley, I think it was in the 40s, there was a book called The Fitness of the Environment. I don't know if I read it at the time, but I can't remember. But what it did is just describe the world's physical environment, and pointed out that everything about, essentially everything about the world's physical environment was just ideal for life. And so, but of course, you know,
their conclusion then
that
is
that came first, apparently, and then social life came after that. Yeah. So yeah, it's no surprise.
Well, and
but for the person who's who believes in special creation, you know, that's the thing for them to believe in.
That's called the
physical environment is made by God, and therefore,
And that certainly was not left in the 40s. I mean, you still hear that all the time. Well, you know, the fact that we're living in this universe that's totally perfectly tuned for us shows that God made it for us, you know, rather than looking, you have this universe and then we evolve within it, you know.
I don't know who Carl Sagan's wife is, but she said a very nice thing.
And Green.
Talking about whether we were able to communicate with extraterrestrial beings.
Uh-huh.
And she said, we've had millions of years with creatures that share 99% of our DNA, and we've never been able to say a word to them. All this time, we behaved and everything was so close that we can't get anything. What makes us think we can say something to a creature we can't even visualize?
Oh, that's what it would totally
say. Well, I have an idea how to get started.
Maybe not even carbon-based creatures.
How about taking some chimpanzees that know sign language and sending them to definite school and see if we can get them to a high school and reading Shakespeare and history? We might be able to get some advice from them.
As far as the...
Well, we can do a little genetic engineering and introduce some human genes into bonobos.
Right. You sound like a Michael Crichton.
There was a great cartoon when the first creature that went to space was the monkey. I forget what his name was. They had him, and he was lecturing the astronauts, and they were all sitting there, and the monkeys up at the. They said, now right around here, he said, you'll get a real urge to eat a banana. So you can't have this.
You can point out to these guys that there were two space alien abductions in the Bible, and it couldn't lie to them. And how would you expect the ancient Israelites to recognize a flying saucer? Wouldn't they call them a flaming chair? What else would it be?
You would fit right in at a UFO convention. That's exactly what they'll tell you.
You know what? I believe in UFOs. I believe the unidentified part.
Right. Makes sense.
Man, nothing wrong with that term.
What's the name of the group that has been discriminated against in Iran because they don't believe in God? They believe that everything was created by aliens who came to Earth. The Raelians or
something?
Raelians.
They're actually discriminated against in a lot of different places because they're crazy.
Yes, but specifically they're discriminated on the religious grounds because they don't accept the existence of God because they have this alternate theory, which is just as wacky, but it's different. And they've been threatened with imprisonment and execution, that sort of thing.
They will proudly admit to being atheists. In fact, they tried to join several different atheist organizations.
Right.
Who let them in.
Who looked at them and said, well, yes, it's true you don't believe in God, but, you know, you're not exactly what we would call rationalists.
Right. Getting back to what Richard said about the blasphemy laws, Humanist Union media page has links to a couple of articles. One of them from the International Humanist and Ethical Union on titled Belief Groups Unite to Oppose UN Blasphemy Laws. So they've been an important group, that international humanist group, in opposing the pressure in the United Nations to pass these blasphemy laws.
Do you know how they're defining blasphemy?
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Well, it's defined differently in different countries, but the general term means saying or writing something disparaging about a religion.
Yeah, and about all religions.
Or about religions in general or any particular religion.
Religion in
would,
general.
Would generic blasphemy be okay because it wasn't directed at any particular group?
Depends on the country.
It depends on each country.
So what kind of blasphemy laws of the UN printing and passing.
Yeah. Well, criticism of Islam.
The UN itself can't pass laws. All they can do is encourage people to adopt standards. But one of the standards that they've already adopted under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is the right of free expression.
Right. So how can you do a blasphemy thing if you've got a right to free expression? Yeah. That's kind of counter.
It's whittling away at that right.
What, human beings being contradictory and hypocritical? who would have
done that? I think it comes from the problems the Europe has had with Islamic people every time they find something disagreeable and go into the streets and pretty much causing riots. I think the effects of these blasphemy laws is coming from that sort of behavior, but the way they're written is generic enough plus ungeneric enough, they could attack us.
Would for a country that passed such laws, would disparaging atheists be considered blasphemy?
Probably not, unless we wanted to call ourselves a religion, and I think most atheists are against calling themselves a religion.
Yeah. Got it.
I was in a discussion with somebody who was talking about the atheists in general in Northern Europe, who, because of their speaking out against Islam, were inciting violence. And that this person was not against atheists as such, but as a group, he was quite angry because he felt that they were taking it way beyond just expressing their atheism and were attacking Islam to the point that it was not safe.
That's why they need a law to protect people.
So we've got
being slandered.
And if the anti-blasphemy laws are being put into place, you know, for that purpose, then somebody's not holding up their own legal system, I would think. I mean, there are laws against inciting violence, regardless of what belief system a person has, and that they would enforce laws against inciting violence instead of coming up with anti-blasphemy laws. That to me makes a whole lot more sense.
Well, I mean, if these things go into effect, I mean, I figure it's similar to the whole thing, like where if a woman got raped, she deserved it because she was wearing skin tight clothing or something, you know. So I don't prove, I mean, I hope it does nothing like it comes to effect.
Well, this would really hurt women's rights.
Oh,
because that's one of the major things that in Sharia and their laws. So in a way, it's illegal. We're against some of the legalities of Muslim laws, stoning women if they are said to have committed adultery or something like that. So this is where it would hurt women. And I would think women's organizations would be aware of this. They wouldn't have the right to speak up then.
They are gradually working on it.
It would seem as though the lines really can't go with this thing. They're going to reduce it to an absurdity with its calculations. So maybe all we have to do is wait for it to hit the judicial thing somewhere.
Well, people who do these things are lawless anyway. And what difference does it make? It's not going to help anything. You can pass a law against putting bombs on airplanes, and it makes no difference to the people who put bombs on airplanes. So
they don't
go ahead and pass your laws. Let's make a difference to us. We're going to do what we're going to do.
Yeah, well, that's a nice attitude, but if they were going to attack certain people, but these types of laws will lead to attacking more than that sort of behavior.
Well, I'm just thinking
I think you've got a good point, though.
Tribesmen's right.
That what's more important is changing societal norms and attitudes, but you know, a good example is smoking. You know, 20, 30 years ago, I mean,
it's a great example.
That was, you know, everybody smoked.
They had ashtrays on this table.
Yeah, exactly. And that's now it's just socially unacceptable.
Over 50% of the people I know have actually stopped smoking because it's just too expensive for them.
Yeah.
That's the other thing.
And it's socially not acceptable. And so things, you know, you can pass laws, but to really change things, you have to change what the normative behavior in a society.
Yeah. But I think if you're looking at the Quran, that you're going to interpret the Quran the way you're going to interpret it. And regardless of what the laws say, if they don't agree with what you think the Quran says,
right, if it's not.
Well, exactly. We have that in America. We have a bunch of fundamentalists who have one law and another law, and what they can say that they're behaving the law, but you never know whether they're behaving God's law or the law of the land.
There are statements in the Quran which say that infidels must be killed. And of course, just like in Christianity, people who find a particular statement in the Bible,
it
justifies some god awful thing that they do. The extremists among the Islamists do that. They find one or two statements like that buried in the Quran somewhere, and they say, "Well, it's okay then for me to go out and kill anybody I feel is an infidel."
Right. Yeah. So. In some Islamic countries, the normative behavior is if your daughter gets raped, you kill her.
Or even she marries the wrong person you didn't choose.
Raise the question.
But you need to, so that it's more of a shame. You can pass a law, but it's changing. Ultimately, the normative ideas of society has to change.
I raise the question of Islam dominated. Areas, for example, the Kano area in northern Nigeria is one of those where the Islamic law now has been, Sharia has been accepted as part of the local law for the whole state. The northern Nigeria, what they call it, the state that Kano is the capital for. There's several other provinces in that region that have lots and lots of Muslims, sub-Saharan region of northern Nigeria. And we have a connection to this because of a fellow who was we were host family for Whitewater. He was a student at Whitewater back in the 70s. He lives there in Kano, and he's become quite a major figure, I think, in the politics. He's a Muslim. In the politics of that region. I remember I emailed him one time several years ago about the separation of church and state when this was issue was developing in the news. And his answer was, well, we probably won't enforce the Sharia laws.
Shouldn't we have a book then?
Too many countries have gotten that.
Yeah, shouldn't we
have that happen?
But he accepted them as being a good Muslim, it was being not a bad idea.
If you look in these calendars, one of the first two or three pages there is a picture of some of the stuff that's going on in Nigeria. They take their allegations of witchcraft and wizardry very seriously.
Was that the one with the kids?
That's the one with the kids who are that batch of kids is orphans, and because of a variety of different contributing factors, not the least of which is AIDS and malaria. There's an awful lot of orphans in that part of the world, and people have traditionally been a little apprehensive about kids running around unsupervised. And there are a lot of kids running around unsupervised in Nigeria and elsewhere in Africa. And it's all too easy to start blaming these kids for every little thing that goes wrong. Even if the kids aren't there, you say, well, all right, so they weren't there causing mischief, but they caused it from a distance because they're witches or they're wizards. And that's where supernatural thinking leads you.
Where does the love of children, which is international, go when people think like this?
It's been lost in the brain rot.
There's a Pentecostal minister in Alaska. During the election, there was a video showing Sarah Palin going through some type of ritual. He was praying that witches here in the United States want her. But this particular minister went to Africa, to some village. I don't know if it was Nigeria or was it Kenya. But he said that all the problems in this village were started by a witch. And he hounded this poor woman out of the village.
Oh, dear.
So here in the United States, these Pentecostal ministers do that. They go over there and they bring this belief over there.
There's a real tendency for the people from that part of the world to believe in some supernatural things. I was shocked. We had a group of four of those students from Nigeria back in the 70s. And one day we had them over for dinner, and we were talking about, I think it was a letter some of you received, one of them had received from a relative in Nigeria who had put a curse on somebody, and it was a student here in the United States or something, I'm forgetting the details, using one of those dolls, and you stick a pin in the doll. And I commented, you know, this is absolute absurdity, nothing like that can happen. And all of those university students who were, a couple of them were very, very bright, one of them ended up getting his PhD in this country, all looked at me and said, well, we believe that. They really can do that. Somebody in Nigeria.
Did they have to disappear?
Somebody who believes
can bewitch somebody, you know, anywhere in the world.
But it's important that the person somewhere else in the world knows what they're saying, and that that's part of their belief system. They don't make the connection between what one believes and what they think is happening over there. And I wonder, can anyone tell me an instance where there's been a negative response to a doll being poked when the person didn't know about it?
Probably some coincidence.
Don't care about it if it is.
I can tell you a story. I worked in Bangladesh for 2 years in some country to build a power plant. And during the power plant phase of building it, these guys would all pray, you know. But we got it set. They didn't all have to pray at once. This guy would pray to leave this guy and do it that way. And then we went on a night shift with this crew. And I was the only, I was a shift supervisor. And I called them together and I said, now, during construction, you know, I really respected your religion. Now, I expect you to respect mine. And I said, I pray too. I pray sometimes like this. And I thought that was so funny. And they thought it was just outrageous. They felt that I was, that they felt bad. They thought they had ridiculed me. And I thought, that's it for humor. They just didn't get it.
Well, humor does not translate.
Have had some worldwide consequences. The one I think of is it's quite possible that the polio eradication program would have succeeded already if it hadn't been for the rumors about the vaccine causing AIDS.
Yeah, that was just devastating.
The whole world I think the lesson from this is what false rumors do we accept among ourselves instead of pointing a finger?
That's true. It's always easy to
see. If I knew what they were, I'd tell you.
Right. It's always so easy to see that.
There's a lot of that against homeless people.
And somebody else.
But you know,
homeless people get very bad press.
But when we were building this plant, I'd be on shift sometimes, and we were about 2 miles out, or 2 miles, about an hour and a half out, and then a Land Rover to get to the power plant. And if I was, let's say, on the night shift, and you'd see the taillights of the other Americans heading away, and I'd be the only American there. And there were probably maybe a million Muslims between me and my family and me and the airport, and I never feared any of it. Never, there were all people, and I knew, or I almost thought, that if I had problems, I could knock on somebody's door and help me. And so it isn't, you know, it isn't all that widespread. It never occurred to me that they would be violent toward me.
Well, and there's the whole hospitality thing, wasn't it?
Well, they were just people. I mean, just people.
Joe Elderman was talking about going into the Pakistani Afghanistan border, but he was the guest of someone, even though he was an American, and that there was problems, there was trouble, but because he was the guest of somebody that they very much, you know, there was no question that he would be wouldn't be safe. I mean, they bent over backwards to make sure he was safe and that he got where he needed to go because he was their guest. And so that was an important part.
If you could say that that's literally true, that that proper treatment of guests is a sacrament in Islam, and it's just as important to them as the Eucharist is to Catholic, what do we call them, Catholics.
A lot of this can be explained through evolutionary theory, and and Richard Dawkins has suggested that memes, which are ideas, are propagated in much the same way as genes are, which is to say that the ones that are successfully adapted to a particular environment are the ones that will survive and thrive. And so if you remember that much of Islam developed in northern Africa in the desert culture, you understand that that the survival of that particular combination of ideas, just like the survival of people, was dependent on folks being able to take care of the wandering strangers. And the parts of the society that didn't do that died out, because after a while, you know, if you didn't take care of your neighbors or the people that needed water, you know, if you had an oasis and you didn't take care of the strangers who came through, well, after a while, you died out too. And so the idea of hospitality survived and thrived in the desert culture because the people that didn't have that idea or didn't propagate that idea didn't survive to pass their ideas along. And the same thing is true of a whole flock of other ideas, like the one that says it's okay to kill the infidels. You know, there's absolutely no reason in the physical world to suggest that there's anything wrong with that as an idea. I mean, we may approach that with moral revulsion, but if that turns out to be a highly successful meme, you end up, you know, the societies that have that end up propagating it at the expense of all the others, and that's the way humanity ends up. There's nothing foreordained about any of these given philosophies. Each one of them is in competition against all the others to establish its niche in society. And some of the most successful ones will drive the other ones out of existence altogether.
Like the Nazis.
The Nazis could very well, had things taken a few different turns along the line, Nazism could very well have dominated the world and everybody would think it was a swell idea.
Those that didn't get killed. In it.
Right, because the ones that didn't think it was a swell idea would be dead.
And there's a good modern example of that in Alaska versus here. Here we tend not to pick up hitchhikers. If you're in Alaska out in the bush, you pick up any hitchhiker you see because you may be the only car that's going to go by there for 2 or 3 hours. You can't leave people out there. Or if somebody drives off the road, you stop. It's just absolutely, my daughter says, unquestioned that is the way you behave because the population is so sparse. It's kind of like the North Africa thing. Even in current culture, you can see the difference between how people, say, behave to a hitchhiker in Alaska versus here.
Well, there's still sort of
a difference between Dayton
County and rural Iowa. It's the same difference.
I asked a guy, one of the Muslim guys once, I said, what is the problem between you and the Hindus? Why is all this antagonism? And he said, well, they worship the cow and we eat the cow. And I said, well, yeah, that's pretty serious. I don't know how you get around that one.
Okay, let's go. Vegetarians, they get along fine.
Yeah, the world was all vegetarian.
Let's go domestic. I didn't bring any special articles, but I think as a topic of conversation in future things, it would be interesting to compare the pro-religious Obama versus the trying to be a little bit secular Obama. There's a number of articles in humanist books, the Atheist Secular Alliance, which basically point out that for every time Obama does anything remotely secular, he also does something religious, like the new... who's the head doctor person? What's the title?
Surgeon
General. Yeah, has previously argued against abortions, religiously based abortions.
He's trying to be
example.
Balanced, is all I think.
What?
Yeah, he's trying to be balanced.
Kind
of the middle of the road.
Could say he'd be middle of the road, but on the other hand, he's being doing an awful lot not.
Yes, but if you would see some of the emails I would get from people who were conservative, it was unbelievable. You know, like, his mother is an atheist, and this is terrible. He's terrible because that, and let alone not being born in this country and all that. Yes. You know. and accusing him of two things: his mother being an atheist and his father a Muslim. He's torn between the two. He's really a Muslim, but he has an atheist mother. And you know, they don't quite know where to put him, which category.
Progressive magazine, at the beginning of his, when he was, you know, pretty much assured of being elected, pretty much said that how you want Obama to go depends on how much you push him. So that if secular America wanted to push him towards, you know, science, if the more you write in, the more you say to him, the better it would be to get science-educated, rational stuff out on the field. And I would argue that since the healthcare initiative, for example, was seriously disrailed by religious right, we didn't do that good a job.
It's like what Roosevelt said. I think it was Roosevelt when he came in, and people were. Mm-hmm. He said, "Go out and make me do it." And you know, he would agree with people who came and talked to him. He said, "Yes, and make me do it."
Yeah,
just what you're saying.
I just read that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's probably a characteristic of successful politicians across the board.
Mm-hmm. But it
really
also
says I'm
this is right. I mean, it really does. That a lot of responsibility falls on our shoulder as public to push.
Mm-hmm. All right. So maybe towards the end of 2010 we should do a program on what is Obama's real position on certain questions and see what the evidence has accumulated by them.
Mm-hmm.
And then how about other ideas for programs for 2010?
I have an idea. First, I'm particularly interested in population growth. There's a serious problem I mentioned during the service today. And I think it would be very useful for us to have a program on the religious aspects of it, whether faith and religion are closely related to population or not. I got off the web this morning, I got this thing, which is something like 150 pages of blog, but summaries of various ideas on the subject. So it's out there, a huge amount of stuff.
Yeah.
I printed out the first 6 pages of it this morning.
I think that'd be a great
topic. It's a complicated. Sorry, give you a little more information. So in the first or the second one of these on this printout here, religion in Cairo. In the original Cairo conference, 170 plus countries approved the principles, but objections came from nations with religious factions, including Catholic and Islamic fundamentalists, Argentina, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and the Vatican, Algeria, Libya, Malta, and Sudan. Specific objections that have been raised, include the Commission on Population and Development's recommendations that A, reproductive health services should include new methods of emergency contraception. That is their objective to that. B, abortion be safe and work. Safe where it's legal. See, young people have full access to sexual and reproductive health education and services. And the last statement is that the Muslim world has the world's highest population growth rate, 3.5% per year on average.
Well, probably the men do what they want and the women have no choice. Yep.
That's half of it. The other half of it is that much of the Muslim world is sitting on top of the world's largest reserves of oil, and they're awash in cash. And so they can afford to expand a population that up until the beginning of the 20th century was constrained by the environment to a very small size. And now they can afford to import pretty much everything they want because they got all this oil money. That's not going to last.
But they don't understand the issue then.
Well, they understand that this is their time in the sun and they're taking maximum advantage of it, just the same way the United States did. I mean,
worldwide,
we ballooned up to 310 million people in no time flat because we had all these resources.
Worldwide ecological studies show that we can't have all these people.
Right, but that doesn't...
Well, they're not thinking about those terms.
But that doesn't tell you, you know, if you've got the ability to support a large family and the inclination to have one, you aren't concerned about planetary perspectives. You're concerned about your own gratification, self-concerns, and so you don't engage in communal thinking. And the religions certainly encourage that.
Here again, as Barbara said, there is societal norms of moving in the other direction. Now, when you hear someone say, "I have six children," your eyebrows
a little bit shocked. Yeah,
and most people. And I'd love to have more children, but I have two, that's enough.
Yes.
So these norms do change, and of course, if you don't make family planning accessible, then whatever they think they'd like for a natural family, they won't achieve it.
I was reading in the Washington Post, which, by the way, has stopped publishing. December was its last issue. And
what's that now?
The Washington Post.
Daily. I mean, the weekly.
Weekly.
Oh, weekly. Oh,
yes.
I was thinking that
picture. Yeah. And we've always enjoyed that. Anyway, there was an article about Yemen, and young girls are married off at 8 years old, and then they have a baby at 12, and then continue. And this is thought to be very good. And have no choice, of course, who they marry. They could marry a 53-year-old man or 20. I mean, they're all older. And so, you know, this, as you said, is the norm. And it would be changing their culture.
Tribal beliefs. Yeah, there was an interesting article in the science section of the New York Times a few months ago. And it was talking about population and ecology and stuff, and said that as... Let me see if I can remember exactly how this went. But as you get more affluent economies, we think about the more affluent people using more energy. But there's a peak point of affluence where then the energy consumption begins to fall because the affluent people tend not to have lots of children, and they can afford to get higher technology. You know, they can afford a Prius and a solar collector and things like that that start to take them past that peak and reduce the energy, which was kind of counter thinking to, you know, the more money you get, the more you consume, the more energy you would consume. So they said there's a peak point, and over that you start going down, but they were questioning if we would be able to get enough people up to that peak level where we could go over that hill.
And
over
if
the
they come down from a very high point, it's still not down very high.
Right, but they were saying that really did make a significant difference. Which was a whole new counterintuitive way of thinking.
Maybe the internet will help to teach them that the rest of the world is something some other things. Maybe they'll start paying attention to it.
If they get on the internet.
I have
a question about Yemen. You mentioned Yemen. I have here a printout that we got that you can get on the web of fertility rates. That was the numbers of women, of children, the average woman in the society has in her lifetime. And Yemen, as of about a year ago anyway, the estimate was 6.41. average in Yemen, which is one of the very highest in the world. This is comparable to Uganda, Congo, Angola.
What's
it's a little
rate?
Less
Then Mali and Niger, which are even higher, they're 7.3 and 7.4.
But this is how many children are born. Does it say how many reach survive to reproductive age? How many of the children survive to reproductive age? Because that's the significant figure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there's...
You're going to lose 20% of your children.
But, of course, modern medicine, you get people are doctors that are trying to save lives. And the focus is on keeping the kids from dying.
But still, her point of infant mortality does make a difference. Levels do make a difference.
Did you have an
idea? Well, with modern medicine, you can reduce that.
To see if you can get
the reduce that infant mortality fairly easily.
Okay, your turn.
I'm sorry.
I have another idea for a discussion. I just finished reading an excellent book about the future of bioethics. It's by Howard Brody at University of Michigan, Madison. It's a very enlightened book about bioethics, and I think that's an appropriate book. And perhaps other people can find some sources too. He's not
transplanted body parts.
He's not tooting any particular horn.
Is that something you'd be willing to summarize and present?
Yeah, sort of. I can also, in a few months. As the time comes,
John?
Yes.
Another idea. We're talking about censorship and how there's certain ideas like don't yell fire in a crowd of theater, perhaps unless there's a fire. Are there other things that are equally justifiable? Could we discuss it from a proactive point of view rather than from the point of view of prohibition?
That'd be a very interesting topic.
And one of them is a cuss word and the other isn't, and how come?
I think they both are cuss words.
Well, I'm talking about ours.
Yeah, I think censorship issues, especially as regard to religion being put above criticism.
Yeah, that's a very, very important issue.
Yeah.
I think that's an excellent topic to produce violence in your society if you want to reduce it. When I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Paraguay, we were forbidden to promote birth control. That was Peace Corps volunteers couldn't do that. But we could, and we also couldn't hand out condoms, but we could take all the condoms we wanted for our own personal use. And people could take grosses of them. and that's what they did. And they handed them out. And it was okay. But as long as you said it was for our own personal use and put up a sort of sly remarks.
You just didn't happen to safely store them, huh? Is that it?
And it did turn out that in the village near me, there was a Peace Corps couple that stayed there, and they furnished condoms to this other couple for all the time they were there. They had four children when they came, four children when they left. We went back 2 years later, and they had two more children after the volunteers left. And these people, the women were being educated. They didn't have anything. All they had was condoms. You can't just generalize and say, well, the men won't use them. Well, sometimes they will, because sometimes they got to support those children too. And the women, the one thing about condoms is pretty obvious. And there's nothing suspicious about it, either use it or isn't. And so I think that one of the big things is just free condoms.
Available.
Without any women's liberation, without anything, just pass out the condoms, and later on, we'll talk about the other stuff.
Well, what about religious prohibitions against contraception?
I know, that's the problem. I'm not saying we could do it, but I say if I had my way, I'd put all these programs aside and I'd just pass out a whole bunch of condoms.
You say they'd probably use it anyway.
They're cheap. They're easy.
Religious stuff.
Well, look at Italy. It's got one of the lowest,
and Spain.
Lowest birth rates in the world.
And in Spain, and Portugal, all those Catholic countries.
You know,
so the Catholic Church is not effective there as it is in Latin America.
Right, yes.
Right. And in the United States.
Is this article that had that comment about Maldino in it?
There's, this is something on the web, by the way, about that. Catholic Education Resource Center, they call it. And these are quotes from publication of that from that center that were included on the webpage, are connected to the webpage of the population. And these are summaries of publications of various sorts from the standpoint of the Catholics. And for example, this one says, Dr. Cousin, this is a quote body article, a book that Jacqueline Cousin wrote in 1988. She shatters the false dogmas that humanity is multiplying at an unsustainable rate. And unless population is controlled by every government and private method, mankind will face disaster. She explains the history of the population control movement, reveals the false economics and the model ideology behind population control, and the false claims of sex education and U.S. governmental involvement in family planning around the world. But that's typical of about
And you read the books they're talking about?
Books and articles that are reviewed from the standpoint that chose specifically by these Catholics
I've
put on their webpage to inform other Catholics of how, you know, how to live their lives.
They aren't getting very far. That's a great majority of Catholics in this conversation.
Yeah. There were a lot of female sterilizations in Paraguay that were never talked about. They'd say, well, she had such a hard time having that child, she can't anymore. Mm-hmm. And you hear that again and again.
Well, that was really the first one in the practice. Women had hysterectomy
conversation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She says, such a difficult birth that she just can't have anymore.
Any more?
We've already heard that enough times. You know what's going on.
More ideas as we wind things up now?
I'm sitting on a couple of ideas. One is I've been enjoying reading the Washington Monthly's Saturday blog, which is called News from the God Machine. And I'd be willing to do a program on a session on sharing some of their ideas and perhaps from some other blogs. But it's a weekly little dose, and I could talk about what that is. The other one depends upon people's interests. And I suppose it would be best called Annotations from My Grandfather's Bible. My atheist grandfather went through his Bible and illuminated almost every page. And there are some fun things in there. I'd be willing to share some of that.
Would that be similar in any ways to the Jefferson Bible, where Thomas Jefferson, they took a lot of things out?
Yeah, I think he took things out. His grandfather was putting things
putting
out.
Things in.
Jefferson Bible ended up about this. Well, it's the New Testament.
Another possible title is A Curmudgeon's Bible.
Another thing that several people bought copies of this book by the humanist chaplain of Harvard University, Greg Epstein, Good Without God, and this slogan is also being used on billboards in certain cities which have a support from the United Coalition of Reason, which is a national group that's supporting local coalitions to publicize groups, freethinker, atheist, humanist groups that band together in cities to help them to raise public awareness of the existence of these groups and get interested people to join. So this might be a topic for a future program. Greg King takes a position somewhere between the more aggressive atheists such as Dawkins and Harris, and even though he considers himself a humanist and an atheist, he sees value in recognizing the better aspects of liberal religion, and he's not ready to throw out all religion.
He has a nice section in there where he has kind of outlined his take on the ethics of humanism. It's just, a few pages, I think. And then he has also taken the Ten Commandments and side by side put a humanist take on them, or not, as the case may be. But
sounds like we could break that down into two or three different discussions. Yeah.
That relates to John's idea of a universal anthem, a hymn for the world. That is the idea of taking these, proverbs, or also things like other things in Proverbs, but all different religions have some version of this. It's a guide to how to live good lives as good citizens as well. So kind of gather all those together from different religious backgrounds.
Thank you all for coming, and more ideas as they come in, please let me know.